From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
I tell people that with Sally and Tom that I put two things I love very much, history, specifically American history, and theater, and I put them in a super collider, and it's like a smash-up mashup. Boom! And we see what happens. And it's a lot of fun. We've been having a lot of fun with the show.
Oh, there are moments that are truly, truly funny, and then moments that are absolutely not. And you juggle that so well.
Thank you.
Today, we're diving into the world of theater, history, and the act of creation through the lens of MacArthur Fellow and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks, or SLP, as her friends call her. SLP has the unique ability to intertwine the complexities of American history with the vibrant energy of theater, creating works that challenge, entertain, and provoke thought. And this is particularly true of her current play, Sally and Tom, now having its New York premiere at the Public Theater, where SLP is playwright in residence. A meta play about a theater company putting on a play about Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, Sally and Tom is a fascinating exploration of theater, history, and the power of storytelling. And it exemplifies SLP's talent for sparking nuanced conversations about America's past and present. I had the enormous pleasure of speaking with Susan Laurie Parks, and I began our conversation by asking her to tell me a little bit more about Sally and Tom.
Sure. Let's see if I get it right. Sally and Tom concerns a theater troupe, a low-budget, no-budget theater troupe. They call themselves Good Company. They are putting on a play about Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. Sally Hemings, of course, being the, among other things, the mother of seven children and also the one of the enslaved people owned by Thomas Jefferson, one of our great founding fathers, who is also a brilliant writer and an architect also. So they're putting on a play. And it's really like one of the things it's about, we could say, is, well, there's a lot of love in the play, Sally and Tom. But the story of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson is not, you know, your traditional love story, right? There's love there, but the play Sally and Tom really takes a look at how we have a lot of joy when we are making things, or as I say in a note, how we are making the stuff that nightmares are made on. So there's a lot of fun in the play. There's a lot of joy. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of love between the characters, but it's not your traditional, like, everybody, you know, hurrah, America. It's, let's celebrate America. Let's really celebrate America. Let's respect America. Let's take another look at America with love, with devotion. And there are a lot of tough conversations you got to have when you're loving someone or something. And that's what we're having in Sally and Tom. Yeah.
Well, the play absolutely deals with very difficult and fraught issues, enslavement and its traces still on this country, mm-hmm. a man with an enlightened philosophy who actually can live with owning people.
Right.
There's rape, there's sexual consent, and there's the coexistence, but very different experiences of a Black family and a white family who are living together.
Right.
But you insist on a nuanced conversation about all of this, even as you focus like a laser on the facts of the case.
Yes. I think nuanced conversations, the ability to have nuanced conversations, will be our salvation as a culture. Really, we need to work. If we haven't been working those muscles, because maybe they've gotten a little slack because we've had our gadgets in our hands too much, or, you know, all you've been lifting is the remote, some of you. But I do think that the ability to have the nuanced conversation, that's going to really, really be the thing that allows us to move forward as a world culture, as a universal culture. Just the ability to listen, the ability to hear, the ability to say the things that need to be said, the ability to invite people to the table, the ability to see yourself in a new light, to extend your hand, whether it's to someone that you'd call the other or someone across the aisle. or, you know, someone across a crowded room. Those kinds of just basic human skills, people. Yes, Sally and Tom, we practice them all. The good company, the theater troupe practices them, not without difficulty. And the folks in 1790 also practice them, yeah.
Yeah, no one ever said it was easy.
No.
One thing I just loved is that there are, what, 8 performers?
Yes, there are 8 performers.
And every one of them, even the ones who don't have that much stage time, they're also vivid.
Yes, yes.
And that's a combination of your writing and their performances.
Yes, yes.
That's wonderful.
Yes. Well, we have the best actors in the universe. And Sally and Tom is a play where each character, no matter their what their station is, you know what I mean? Their station in life, whether they're the lead or the not lead, you know, each character has a journey, a very significant journey. Each character receives an invitation to the table, if you will, is allowed in the room, gets to have a series of moments. It's the practice of inclusivity. And that's what it looks like. And it just makes everything so much more vibrant and beautiful in life as in theater, in life as an art, you know?
Yeah. Certainly felt that way in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
You have 3 powerful monologues in this play.
Thank you.
By Thomas, by James, who's Sally's brother and a valet to Thomas Jefferson and is also an enslaved person.
Yes.
And then finally, Sally herself.
Yes.
And they're very different. They're very interesting. With James, he's talking to Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
Whereas Sally and Thomas are talking to us,
yes,
the audience, I think.
Yes.
Talk about that and creating those monologues.
Yes.
Which one did you start with?
You know, my writing is very much a spiritual practice. So the person who let me in, right, was Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson let me in. He was the first one that I wrote. His monologue isn't the first one in the play, but to be able to see him, see beyond the carved in stone monument that so many of us, you know, we revere him, we respect him, and we only see him in this one kind of way, a lot of us. Others only see him in another kind of way. How could he do such things? And there's truth in both aspects of him. And that's what makes him, I think, an interesting character and a character worth listening to. So he speaks a lot about, you know, his achievements and his talents and his skills and his curiosities. I mean, he's a man who remodeled, he says, almost every house he lived in. Putting a dome on Monticello was one of his achievements. Also, he's a very great writer. That's something. The monologue doesn't stop there. It also talks about the depth of his emotion. In the monologue, he talks about being literally at sea, surrounded by nothing but water, surrounded by nothing but tears. And this is a different way to look at Thomas Jefferson. You know, in Sally and Tom, we don't only humanize the enslaved people. We also humanize the people who owned slaves. Both things are happening.
Yeah. When I was in the theater, I was thinking of the Jefferson quote, when I think that God is just, I fear for my country. You don't quote that exactly, but that's really explored, I think, in that monologue.
Yeah. And he, rightfully so, he is proud of his accomplishments and reminds us that he is at the great intersection of the way we see our country. And that's very important. Then, of course, you know, Sally's, I think, monologue I wrote next, her monologue comes at the end of the play. In a way, she's remembering things about her life in the sort of spiritual tradition of you remember things, you bring the body back together, literally remembering things. And you remember things in a way to, she says, cast the burden. It's a spiritual activity of casting the burden, meaning recalling things as a way to let them go. We say in spiritual conversations, I cast the burden and I set myself free. The contemporary characters quote more than once esteemed scholar and educator Mary McLeod Bethune, who says forgiveness is not forgetting, it's letting go of the hurt. So we're not talking about covering up anything or papering over anything. We're talking about recalling things so that we can let them go and move forward as a people, as a country, as a group of folks. And then James's speech came, I think I wrote last, but it comes first in the play. And it's a great point of examination and contention for both the characters in 1790 and the characters in the contemporary day, because the question of his speech, which is eloquent and passionate and gorgeous, and he says all the things that need to be said to the man, to Thomas Jefferson. And yet the question in the Sally and Tom is there a place for that kind of talking in our world?
And that brings us very nicely to the fact that this is meta-theatrical.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what that allowed you to do. And I think that speech is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. By writing a play about writing a play. James Baldwin, who was the great scholar, writer, activist James Baldwin, I had the great fortune of studying creative writing with him at Hampshire College. I was at Mount Holyoke College as an undergrad. And in the early 80s, Mr. Baldwin taught creative writing at Hampshire College. I took what he said was his first creative writing class he ever taught. And there I was with 14 other students around a library-sized table, learning to, as I say, how to conduct myself in the presence of the spirit, how to pay attention, how to show up. And one of his wonderful things he would say in his writing is, we are trapped in history and history is trapped in us. So a play that's about playwriting and a play that's about playmaking, Sally and Tom, to me, is very much about how the world is made. You know, like Shakespeare, you know, all the world's a stage, you know what I mean? Or Hamlet would say, hold a mirror up to nature. So writing a play about playwriting, I'm really engaging in a conversation about how the world is made. As Luce says late in the play, we're making the world, we're not just living in it. How each character in the play, how each of us as human beings in the world, how we make the world every day through our actions, how the characters in Sally and Tom are making the world every moment through their actions. Something's scripted, something's not. Some things need to be re-scripted because of things that happen. And so what that allows for the characters in the play is to perhaps discover some trapdoor. So instead of just history being trapped in them and them being trapped in history, that the meta-theatricality of the play allows for us to find trapdoors, us to find ways out, us to find crossroads of compassion, us to find clearings where we can dance and sing or weep, you know, places where we can find freedom, where we can claim freedom, where we can celebrate history. That's not just saying, yay, it's all good. You know what I mean? You celebrate history by falling on your knees and weeping, and that's okay. We have to embrace those kinds of moments in our culture. It's okay to weep. It's okay to say, gee, I was great, but I might not be as great as I might have been. To respect yourself enough to look again at yourself. You know, to rehearse, rehear your own words. All that is happening in the play. It's a lot, but it's fun. It's fun.
And, you know, all props to the director because, you know, everybody is embodying multiple characters. And at the same time, it's always very clear who's who on that stage. Oh,
thank you. Thank you, Josephine. It's Steve H. Broadnax III. We call him SHB3, is a brilliant director. This is the first time we've worked together. We worked together initially at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis when we did Sally and Tom there a couple years ago. That's where we had the world premiere. And I'm so thrilled to be in collaboration with Steve H. Broadnax. Of course, he's done, you know, Thoughts of a Colored Man on Broadway. He's very esteemed. He is such a joy to work with. And when it's game time, Brother Broadnax comes in and says, okay, everybody, it's game time. And everybody's like, everybody knows what that means. There can be a joy in pursuing excellence and in attaining excellence. And that's what we do every day in the room.
I was going to say, and a joy in paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Like there is a joy in paying attention. There is a joy in showing up. You know, the first award I got as a child was I was in either kindergarten or first grade. Anyway, I still have the little plaque that they gave me. It was for perfect attendance. And I love that. I have the little plaque on my bookshelf, perfect attendance. And I said, yeah, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be showing up.
Well, collaboration is so key in theater. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious how the collaboration worked with the director and with the actors mm-hmm. in Sally and mm-hmm. Tom.
Yes, yes. In Sally and Tom, I mean, Steve and I worked very closely together. We, in the rehearsal room, of course, I defer to him when he's giving direction to an actor because he is highly skilled in the language, in transmitting, you know, the text to the actors, the blocking to the actors, what the set will look like, all those wonderful things. So I oftentimes stand by his elbow and say, hey, could we try this? Should we try this? And then he'll communicate that to the actor because that's the most effective way to help them understand it. And yet, you know, I've got a million and one ideas about things. We get in each other's lanes all the time. So I'll have ideas about staging and all that kind of thing that are transmitted and that you see on stage. And he has plenty of ideas about the text and you'll see in the text. One day he and I were talking and I said, oh, I want to articulate what Good Company is trying to do. They're trying to reach a wider audience, right? And he said, a wider audience? And we laughed, we burst out laughing. And I said, Steve, it's going in the play. So we put it in the play and now it's in a scene with Luce and Mike and it's a really funny moment. But also the actors, you'll see a moment in the play in Sally and Tom where the actors are throwing ideas into the pot. A good company is throwing ideas in the pot. And that happened plenty of times. I would make a joke like, what you say might end up in the play. And that happened lots. But in terms of the overall structure, the main, you know, story, the bones, the basic architecture is very much my responsibility. And I delight in that. You know, and there is a hierarchy, you know, collaboration is great. And there is a hierarchy. Sometimes, yeah. You know, people would be talking, and I'm like, quiet, please. The writer is in the room and the writer is writing, you know, so things like that. But it's all understood. I also don't jump on stage and perform for them. I would ask them to do something. So it's collaboration with an understanding of, you know, what your department is, what my department is, what your lane is, what my lane is.
You know, these characters live in your head and they live on the page. Can you tell me about that moment when you actually see them embodied on the stage?
It's an absolute joy. So far in my career, I have not been one of those writers who, I mean, I talk to some of my friends and colleagues, you know, they're disappointed. Oh, it's not as good as I had in my head. You know, for me, so far, you know, I have been the opposite. It's always a lot better than I imagined in my head. You know, I mean, I think I wrote this play for the costumes, really. Every character has a really pretty costume. No, that's silly. Of course I didn't. But at the same time, I did write in the script notes to the design. Like one character, Maggie, says, because my costume is killer. So that was a note, a hint to production that we wanted awesome costumes, which Rodrigo definitely gives us some of the most beautiful outfits. It's just so much better than I had in my head, of course, because the actors are so great and the set is beautiful. I sat watching the show yesterday afternoon and was just so pleased and happy for the company that we have managed to get the show to this beautiful, beautiful place.
I'd like to just briefly touch on your relationship with music because there's such musicality in your language. I mean, in this conversation, certainly in your work, and you've written music.
Yes,
I mean, your play, Plays for a Plague Year.
Yes.
What did you write, 25 songs
Yes. Yeah, Plays for the Plague Year. What a joy that was. We did it. We world premiered at Joe's Pub last year, I guess it was. We won the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Music in a Play. I wrote 25 songs for it. Maybe we actually performed maybe 20. You know, words and music. I have a band called Sula and the Joyful Noise, and we are performing all around town and out of town too. We're like a 6-piece band with a horn section. I was a songwriter before I was a playwright.
That's what I was going to ask you. Did music come first?
Yeah, music came first. And in my experience, writing was a safer space, we could say, than the world of music. So I ended up gravitating more toward writing plays and novels and things like that. And then have in the past 20 years or 15 years allowed myself to step back into my songwriter space. And I'm having a wonderful time. And working with musicians is very different. You know, being in a band, having, you know, my horn section, my husband's a bass player, and we've got, you know, drums and a vibraphone player. You know, it's intense. It's very different from being the playwright sitting in the house giving notes, you know, that kind of thing. So
I bet, yeah. Can you tell me just a little bit about your background, where you're from?
Sure. My dad was in the Army. He was a career Army officer. It's funny, my mom just told me recently, you know, he joined the Army in ROTC. He came from a very economically disadvantaged situation. The Army had just been integrated, and that was the only way he was going to get to college. He wanted badly to go to college. And his family did not have any kind of money. And so he joined the ROTC as a way to get to college. And so he graduated from college and then was a career Army officer. My mom was a college professor, sociology, and later oral history. And we moved all around the country. Yeah. We lived in Germany for a good amount of time. My parents, in their wisdom, they sent me to German school. All the American kids were going to American school. They sent me and my brother to German school. Not only were we the only Black kids in the school, but we had to learn German, which came in handy, of course, as a learning language always does. And also because now my husband is German, so we speak German around the house.
How did you get involved in playwriting?
So there I was studying creative writing with James Baldwin in this creative writing class in the early 80s. As people know, in a creative writing class, you know, each week it will be your turn to present your work, you know, and usually the students would sit at the table and very brilliantly read in a modest voice their works. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I would always read like this. And then she ran across the field and she picked up the, you know, cotton candy. And she said, oh my God, you know, I would be doing that. It was, I don't know why. I do not know why. Maybe because I was a singer songwriter who wasn't singing songs, but I was kind of singing the song. But anyway, I would perform my short stories. And at one point, after class, Mr. Baldwin said, Miss Parks, have you ever thought about writing for the theater? And I was like, no, sir, I haven't. In my mind, in my little tummy, I thought, oh no, he's trying to tell me that I suck as a writer. Because, you know, it's like, get me to a theater, you know, that kind of thing. I thought, oh no, because I didn't like, theater was like what I knew of theater. Again, it was the 80s, you know. All the people I knew who did theater, I was at Mount Holyoke College, and they were all from like New York City. And they all talked like this. Oh, darling, darling, darling. They were all from like New York City. So there was a lot of faking going on. There was a lot of affect and a lot of this kind of behavior. And I was like, I am not like that. I'm real. I like real things, you know, rawr, like that. So I didn't think the theater was a place for me. Although, you know, riding the bus home that evening back to my dorm, I started writing my first play because I thought, well, you know, it's Mr. Baldwin. It's James Baldwin. I might as well give it a try. And, you know, it's like I'm still trying my hand at writing for the theater. I mean, that's basically it's just continued. So that's how I got into it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting because, okay, so with plays for a plague year, really, 25 songs, right?
Yeah.
It's like a theatrical concert.
Yes.
And we have the meta play going on with Sally and Tom.
Yes.
And then you did 365 plays, 365 days, a play a day for a year.
Yes.
It's almost like you're continually creating new structures for your work.
Yes. Strange, isn't it? Yeah. No, thanks. Thank you for acknowledging that. Yeah. For Plays for the Plague Year, yeah, I just sat down and wrote a play a day as a way to just, I wanted us to have something with which we could celebrate when we got back together. And when I started writing those plays, of course, we were all in lockdown. Getting back together was not a sure thing. You know, but I felt like, well, I'll write something. And then when we get back together, we'll have a song to sing together, if you will, a song of days, all the days. And I would just listen to the news or read the news or whatever and write a play about something that caught my eye. Yes. And as you pointed out, it was very much like in 2002, I guess it was, when I started and I wrote a play a day for a year. And that was just as a way to say thank you to theater, because it had given me so much. I'd won the Pulitzer Prize several months before, and I was just saying thank you by just showing up. Again, attendance, perfect attendance, showing up every day and writing a little play as a way to say thank you. With Plays for the Plague, it was showing up every day as a way to say attitude of gratitude while we're in this difficult place. And anytime I would write a song, I would throw it in. I wrote a song when I heard that Chadwick Boseman died. I wrote a song for Chadwick Boseman called R.I.P. the King. Or a song when John Lewis died. As the mourners crossed the Pettus Bridge with his casket, they shouted, we got it from here. And so I wrote a song called We Got It From Here. Or it was a song for John Prine I wrote, because he also passed away during that time. So, you know, songs would come up like that. And I just throw them in, you know, not even knowing if we'd ever come back together. And then we came back together. Oscar Eustace at the Public Theater said, well, why don't you put them on, you know? And I said, really? And he said, sure. And you wrote a part for the writer. Why don't you be the writer? And I'm like, oh, okay. So there I was in Joe's Pub performing the play for 5-6 nights a week with a wonderful group of actors, directed by Nigel Smith. Great direction. Great to work with Nigel Smith, yeah.
Yeah, well, you've had a couple of, I mean, your whole career is extraordinary, but you've really had a couple of extraordinary years. Top Dog, Underdog, your Pulitzer Prize winning play, yes, was recently revived on Broadway. Yes. What a revival that was.
Yes, what a joy. And again, another director, another wonderful director, Kenny Leon, and two brilliant and beautiful and generous and kind and loving actors, Corey Hawkins and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. Just splendid, splendid brothers, you know, righteous brothers, you know, the kind of actors that you want to work with. And I would sit in the in rehearsal when we got into the Golden Theater, which is a beautiful theater on Broadway. And I would shout in rehearsal. They were doing the play, you know, and I'd go, sing the song, like that, because they were up there, so brilliant, so wonderful, so inclusive, because, you know, it's a play about two dudes in a room, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but they were just very inclusive to my thoughts and my contributions, not just because I was the writer, but because they value the opinion of women, which is a great thing in a man.
You were the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for drama back in 2002.
Yes.
I'm wondering, when you think about it, when you think about the past 22 years, what changes you've observed in theater?
Fortunately for world culture, I think it's become more inclusive. I think it's become more diverse. And these words, you know, these words are sometimes hot button issues and triggering for people and on both sides of the aisle, if you will. I think the spirit is generous and loving and encourages inclusion, even when it's difficult, and encourages respect, and encourages understanding, and encourages kindness. These are the truths that I hold to be self-evident, you know. Show up, be kind. You know, don't save your kindness for just the higher ups, you know what I mean? Kindness should be shared and spread. And you know, it's not easy to do every day. But anyway, so I do think that theater has become more open and engaging and more joyous, and also is allowing us to take a look at some things that perhaps we haven't had a chance to look at yet. Inviting in the voices of we would say, underserved communities. Their plays on Broadway, well, last year, you know, you can see, you know, the Thanksgiving play or Fat Ham or alongside with The Piano Lesson and The Death of a Salesman, which was brilliantly, but also Goodnight Oscar, I think it's called. You know, so there's a whole wonderful offering. And I think that the world is hungry for daily bread, meaning sustenance, meaning food that feeds you in a deep way, and not just cash money bread. You know what I mean? I would ask theater, as we continue to be inclusive and expansive, not just to go for the cash money bread, you know, the entertainment dollars, but also to find ways to continue to innovate and find ways where we can offer audiences daily bread, and not to abandon the offering of daily bread in the pursuit of cash money bread. In a way, to bring it back to Sally and Tom, that's one thing that begins to happen with Good Company. They start, the play is the play that they're performing is originally called E Pluribus Unum, Out of Many One. The producer doesn't like the title so much. The writer, Luce, lands on a title that's more appealing all around, to herself included, which is called Pursuit of Happiness. So the understanding of Out of Many One is, I would say, discarded for the endless yearning of the pursuit of happiness. So it's just interesting. So I would hope, as theater, as the arts, as the world continues to expand, as the universe continues to expand, you know, that we can find ways to continue to deliver to each other daily bread.
You are a playwright in residence at the Public Theater.
Yes.
What does this experience allow you to do?
Yeah. As a human person who, I traveled around so much as a kid, you know. And so people say, where are you from? I'm from, like Johnny Cash, I'm from everywhere. But I traveled around so much that I never really felt like I had a home. I mean, always living with, of course, my parents, but never really having a home. And I feel like being the writer in residence at the Public Theater has allowed me to have an artistic home and to put down roots and to have a seat in the good way. And if you, you know, if we were ever to hang out, Josephine, you'd see I'm one of those people who does not sit down. I'm always like dancing around. Even I'm always like in the back of the theater, like dancing around, watching the show, you know. But to take your seat in the way that the scripture or that the books talk about taking your seat and knowing that you have a place that is for you, and the strength that comes from that, and the daring that I've continued to exercise because I have a seat, because I have a chair, you know, at the Public Theater, which is a, you know, a theater. When I was coming up, I always like, wow, it's the Public Theater. And I still feel that way. Wow, it's the Public Theater. You know, because so many great artists have come through that theater. And I had my first play there in 1994, 30 years ago, when George C. Wolfe was the artistic director of the Public Theater, a show in the Martinson where Sally and Tom is, called The America Play, about a Lincoln impersonator. So I've a black man who dressed up as Abraham Lincoln. So that was 30 years ago in the Martinson at the Public Theater, with George C. Wolfe as the artistic director. See, Liz Diamond was the director of that play. And now, 30 years later, there is another play about history and America, and which features people dressing up as historical characters. It's my jam, yeah.
Well, one thing you do at the Public Theater is watch me work.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that.
Can you explain that and what it is you do and how it works?
Yes. Thank you, Josephine. Oh, it's one of my great joys. Watch Me Work. I started it about 14 years ago. A dramaturg friend of mine who at that time worked at the Public Theater, Jesse Cameron Alec, was doing a theater festival on East 4th Street, in some little theaters on East 4th Street. And he said to me, Jesse said, okay, SLP, I've got a lot of plays on the docket already by young writers, and I'd love to include a play by, and I said, oh, by an old writer? And we laughed. And I said, okay, man. And I just started talking. It was unscripted. It was a very weird moment. I opened my mouth and I said, Jesse, I do not have time to write a play for you, but I tell you what I'll do. I'll sit in front of the audience with my red typewriter, and we will work together for 20 minutes. And then for the remaining time in the show, I will take questions from them about their creative process, and we will call it Watch Me Work. It was like something was speaking through me in that moment. So we started it. We had a little theater festival, and then we quickly after that moved into the lobby of the Public Theater. It became a weekly thing. And, you know, people would come, you know, just hang out in the lobby of the Public Theater. We would work together for 20 minutes. And then I would take questions from them about their creative process. COVID happened. I went online, Public Theater, and HowlRound hosted us online on Zoom. And then it was every day. I wanted to do it every single day. During the first months of lockdown, when community really needed, so many people needed somewhere to go. And so many people needed to be around other people. And we could not physically be around other people. Everything was closed down. And so I just said, every day we're going to get online and do Watch Me Work. And we had people from all over the world zooming in. And just, we created a community. And after lockdown, you know, we came back. We came back from everything. Now we're back to once a week. Once a week, Mondays, 5 p.m. You can sign up through the Public Theater website. What's great about Watch Me Work is I'll talk to you in real time about your creative process. You don't have to be in a university program. You don't have to be a matriculated student anywhere. You don't have to live in the United States. All you have to do is have access to some kind of online portal situation. Come on, I'll talk to you about your work and your creative process. It's fun. I love it. I love doing it. I've been doing it for a long time.
And SLP, as we're ending, do you have any final thoughts you want to share about Sally and Tom?
I was thinking, like, things I want to say. Like, we say, you know, in the play, this is not a love story. It's more like a truth and reconciliation story. So just to give people that as a way to think about it. I'm amazed at how the play, it resonates with all kinds of audiences, but especially younger audiences. We had a group of young partners, they call them, at the Public Theater the other night. And it was like, whoa, it was electric. And so that's very moving to me, to know that the transmission is happening. That was joyful. And I think, you know, people coming up and coming into their adulthood or in the first 10, 20 years of their adulthood are very eager and open in ways that are really valuable to our culture. So I would just encourage that openness, people who are coming up, you know, because we need you.
And I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Josephine. This is so fun. What fun.
It was great. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You asked all the right questions.
That was the incomparable playwright, Susan Laurie Parks. We were talking about many things, but most particularly her play, Sally and Tom, which has been extended at the Public Theater through May 5th. You can keep up with her at SusanLaurieParks.com. We'll have links in our show notes to her website and to the Public Theater, where you can get information about Sally and Tom and SLP's project, Watch Me Work. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcast and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.